Greetings again, everyone. When I walked in, I said, where are all the leftists? Everybody's sitting on the right. Maybe it's the war news that does that. Well, we're having a very wonderful, nearly record-breaking response on the website. About 1,200 plus every single day are tapping into it and reading it, and I'm writing virtually a commentary a day. I've been writing a lot and posting them there. And also, we have about a 30-page newspaper getting ready to go. I was working on that a little bit this morning, doing some proofreading and editing. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to cut it down or expand it, but we've got an awful lot of articles that need to be getting out there. Also, this week, as a result of the television program, we had the second highest response we've ever had, 1,302. The highest was 1,370 for the program The Bible, Fact or Fiction. And, of course, this one that I did advertised Peter's story. And so far, we have already entered 10,268 requests for Peter's story into the computer. And by the way, we're less than 3,000 away from 60,000 on the mailing list now. And when you think that only a very few years ago we started out with 800, that is phenomenal growth. So we're very, very happy about that. As I've told you before, I'm using you folks a little bit as a guinea pig, in a sense, because I have had to, of necessity, simply because of lag time in writing, editing, printing, and then in mailing. That takes quite a bit of time. Some of the information that I want to get out to the mailing list and advertise on television, I simply cannot write a brochure or a booklet and have it ready for being mailed out the following Monday or so. So what I'm doing is using taped sermons and advertising them instead, because I can announce them on Monday or Tuesday when I do the television program, put a title on the tape, then come here on the Sabbath day and preach the sermon that I had intended to deliver at that time. And I've already announced the sermon for today to the television audience, which will be coming up today, tomorrow, and Monday. And it's called Deliverers or Conquerors. And so if you don't mind me using this audience as a guinea pig, some of the things that I will be quoting to you, you already know. Some of the information that I have here, I don't think you know anything about, and perhaps some of it will be brand new. As you know, we call it Operation Iraqi Freedom, the war to liberate Iraq. But do the Iraqi people and do the Muslims around the world, about 1.8 billion of them, view the United States as deliverers? Or do they view us as conquerors? Are we there in a preemptive strike to conquer and to occupy a country that allegedly has done us no harm, according to the anti-war demonstrators, according to all of the Al Jazeera and all of the Arab information media, and there are dozens of them? I saw a bank of television monitors the other day in Kuwait City, and they were all Arabic, and they were absolutely omitting any kind of operational information about the American troops, about our advances. They were concentrating wholly upon missiles or bombs that went astray, civilian marketplaces, civilian casualties, women and children, and they're doing it 24 hours a day. They say nothing about ragtag soldiers dressing as civilians, pretending to surrender, and then suddenly ambushing our troops. They say nothing whatsoever about car bombs of a taxi driver who beckons to people as if he needs help, and then in a suicide explosion kills several American troops or soldiers. They say nothing about the bloody U.S. uniforms found in a hospital in Basra, female U.S. uniforms with blood on them. No sign whatsoever of the young women who have been taken hostage, or as they say, as prisoners of war. As a matter of fact, from the Arabic and from the Islamic point of view, this is a new crusade. They believe in their heart of hearts that the Western so-called professing Christian world, the Judeo-Christian world, the U.S., the U.K., and the Zionists, as they call us, are coming into an innocent Muslim country, and we are bringing the cross of Christ and the guns and the bombs and the mortars and all of our guided precision weapons, and we are trying to subjugate this helpless, innocent group of Iraqi, Islamic, Allah praising, five times a day praying public, and waging war against innocent civilians. Let me give you just a little bit of how far some of the leftist liberal information media go in their reporting of the news, even in Western societies. I lifted this off of one of the liberal websites. Quote, far more terrible than the pictures of dead British soldiers, keep that in your mind, far more terrible than the pictures of dead British soldiers is the tape from Basra's largest hospital shown on Al Jazeera that shows victims of the Anglo-American bombardment being brought into the operating rooms shrieking in pain. A middle-aged man is carried into the hospital in pajamas soaked from head to foot in blood. A little girl of perhaps four is brought into the operating room, and they show all of this on a trolley, staring at a heap of her own intestine protruding from the left side of her stomach. A blue-uniformed doctor pours water over the little girl's guts and then gently applies a bandage before beginning surgery. A woman in black with what appears to be a stomach wound cries out as doctors try to strip her for surgery. In another sequence, a trail of blood leads from the impact of an incoming, presumably British, shell. Next to the crater is only a pair of plastic slippers. These Al Jazeera tapes, most of which have never been seen, I'm still quoting, are the first vivid proof that Basra remains totally outside British control, end of quote. So they were taking issue with a statement from the Allied Command Center that Basra was under British control. Now that shows you the liberal bias in some of these websites, and all of you know that priests, rabbis, nuns, and ministers were joining the anti-war protest in San Francisco the other day. You've seen pictures of people who, not satisfied with disrupting traffic in New York, went to Washington, D.C., and they lie down in the road and join hands and wait for the police to come to have to pick them up. And, of course, they don't even walk. They force the police to drag them in their hundreds away. The media unerringly always descends upon the scene, and sometimes the media even outnumbers the demonstrators. And oftentimes, the police outnumber the demonstrators. And has been pointed out, in a time of high red alert, thousands of American policemen and law enforcement officers are having to deal with anti-war demonstrators when they should be out there trying to keep their eyes open about terrorists who might try to attack us, poison our food or water supply, blast high antenna that carry power from dams and hydroelectric projects to cities, and of course protect the citizens. They're not able to do that. Well, the United States and the UK has been surprised by several things, and so have you, I think, because if you believe what the media said just prior to the war, you also are probably surprised by the absence of mass surrenders. Many spoiled Americans who remember the first Gulf War expected the war to be over in 3 to 5 days, and the media, like whimpering little children, like those of whom Christ spake, you just don't measure up. You don't dance to our tune. You don't perform the way we expected to. You're like children in the marketplace, as he said. And so they whimper and they whine and they ask all kinds of slanted, probing questions about whether or not we're bogged down. What is the real reason for the delay? Just how badly did that sandstorm hurt us? And of course, some of them have actually said to the generals in the command center, are you just feeding us a pack of lies, or are we really getting the truth? You can always depend upon the media to have a leftist liberal bias. The U.S. and the U.K. were surprised by the tenacity of the defense. They were surprised by ragtag terrorist attacks by those dressed as civilians who will wave cheerfully as they go by and then attack them at night. And they were certainly surprised by a taxi cab driver pretending to surrender and then triggering a bomb. Yet all over the Muslim world, in their hundreds of teeming millions, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Sudan, Chad, Ifni, Sidi Ifni, bet you don't know where that is, Iraq, Iran, Indonesia, all of the nations in the Middle East, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Bahrain, the citizens even of Pakistan, even though that is a subjugated nation under a man we installed named President Karzai. The people in, Afghanistan, but the citizens of Pakistan are also absolutely anti-American, as the people of Bangladesh, and that is the other Islamic part on the eastern part of India, and many people in India themselves, and all over Russia and China and Europe, Germany, France, nations that we have actually shed our blood to preserve, defend, and protect are totally against the United States. There is far more hostility against this war than there is support, even though President George Bush has about 60-some percent in favor of what he is doing. In the world in general, that is minuscule in comparison to those who are against it. Some of these people in these nations have a very short memory. Many of them are illiterate. Those who are literate don't remember their own history. Some of the young black Americans in the United States, African Americans, would do well to remember the true history of slavery. Because the truth is that it was Arabic, Islamic slave traders who delivered the blacks into the hands of such Western nations as Portugal, Spain, Britain, the United States, nations in Central and South America, and for that matter, nations in the Middle East. Let me give you a little bit of history, just as a vignette, of Spain. Now, a lot of you don't know that some of the way places in Spain bore originally Arabic, that is to say Moorish or Berber, names. You remember the main river in Spain that goes on out through Portugal? It's called Guadalquivir. Guadalquivir. But originally it was Wadi el Heber. Guadalquivir is the Spanish pronunciation of Wadi el Heber, out of the Moorish. And Wadi in Arabic means river, the Hebrew river, the river of the Hebrews. It's been suggested by some researchers that if you look at the rock of Gibraltar, that originally it was called Gibraltar in Spanish, the altar of the Hebrews. What is the name of the Spanish national airlines? Iberia, the silent H. The Iberian Peninsula is where Spain and Portugal are. Where do you suppose it came with a silent H to get the name Eber? Well, the eponymous ancestor of Dan, and remember that the half-tribe of Dan abode in ships, always left their name, and one example of that is when Dan anciently attacked the northern city of Israel called Lachish, and very shortly after its subjugation, renamed it Dan. And from that time to this, you can read many expressions in the Bible, when the Bible is talking about the northern and the southern extremities of the nation of Israel, or Palestine at that time, it speaks of from Dan to Beersheba, doesn't it? From Dan to Beersheba. Well, Dan used to be Lachish. And so the Danites, wherever they went, and that also means that they gave their name to the way places all along from that area between the Black and the Caspian Sea into Central Europe. The Udon is a named river after Dan. The Danube in Latin merely means the river of Dan. Uba is river. Danube. The Danube, named after Dan. The Dniester, Dnieper, named after Dan. Danmark are some of the Danites. We pronounce it Denmark. No, they spell it and pronounce it Danmark, the mark of Dan. And anciently it was named after the Jews, 200,000 of which were taken by Sennacherib and taken up to that area and migrated up there. And it was called Jutland, the Jutland War between them and Britain. And it was called the Jutland, or the land of the Jutes, or the Jews. All right, enough of that. But believe it or not, the invasion of the Iberian Peninsula by Islamic armies occurred in 711 AD. A Berber Muslim army, and the Berbers were a North African tribe that later on became known as the Moors. You know, they got an expression in Spanish, hay moros en la costa. Well, moro is the word for Moor, and the Moor is merely a Berber who is an Islamic invader that took over Spain. And the expression, is the coast clear? You ever heard that in English? Would you be interested to know where it came from? Because when the Moors continually came across in northern Africa and attacked southern Spain, people would look and say, ¿Hay moros en la costa? Are there any Moors on the coast or in the coast? And so we have that in our idiomatic expression. Not idiotic, idiomatic. That is the coast clear? That's where some of that comes from. I thought you'd be interested. All right. There was a leader with a familiar Islamic name, Tariq ibn Zayd, who crossed the straits of the Gibraltar Iberian Peninsula. And, of course, he invaded Spain, and they conquered it. And it was finally the last of the Visigothic kings of Spain, who was Roderick, was defeated at the Battle of Rio Barbate. And in 719, the invading forces were supreme all the way to the Pyrenees, which divide southern France from northern Spain. The progress north was attested to at a battle fought in France between Tours and Poitiers in 732 by the Frankish ruler Charles Martel. Eventually, all of Spain except the Basque country fell under the sword of Islam. Now, there's something I want to point out here as I go along. There's a great deal more, because remember that Islam began in Medina and Mecca. And it spread from there by the sweaty pronunciations of a caravan robber named Muhammad down into Egypt. It subjugated the Christians because, remember, get your history straight, that Muhammad came along 600 years after Christ. 600 years had gone by, during which the Christian religion, nominal Christian religion, had spread into Egypt and the Sudan or Ethiopia, had spread up into all of Europe, up into the British Isles, and the Roman Empire, of course, helped to spread it. And during the days of Constantine, it continued to spread. And great wars began to be waged between the Islamic people and Islam. In all places, in all cases, at all times, was spread by the edge of the sword. It was never spread by missionaries patiently, prayerfully reasoning to win the minds of man. It was never spread in the way Baptists worked to spread the nominal Christian religion in China or in Africa or in other very inhospitable nations. Never. It was always spread by the edge of the sword. Yet these people resent right down to the ground the false charge, not a true charge, that we are trying to impose Western values, Western society, Western Christian religion upon these poor, suffering, innocent, defenseless Arabs who don't even have weapons of mass destruction. Now, let me make a point that dozens of countries whose histories prove it were subjugated by Islam at the edge of the sword. It spread into Turkey. And eventually the Seljuk Turks were subjugated by the Ottomans, and the Ottoman Turkish Empire held sway until General Allenby broke the hold of the Ottoman Turkish Muslim Empire in World War I at the end of that war. In the meantime, the sword of Islam had spread all across all of Northern Africa, into Central Africa. Many traders ended up in Kenya, Tanzania, and the other areas around Mozambique, and are there to this day. And Arab slave traders, and I've got a quotation that's going to be a blistering thing in a moment for you, were selling these poor, ignorant blacks, and as the sword of Islam would constantly move southward, as it did to Ethiopia and the Sudan, there were less and less of these ignorant African tribesmen to prey upon, because the country was then called Islamic. And since they are, in their righteousness, not ever going to attack fellow Islamic republics, are they? Wink, wink. They ran out of Islamic blacks. So they simply went further and further into Eastern and Central Africa, into the Congo and into those areas, and went on over to West Africa. And when the slave traders came to the various places, like later on called Liberia, and loaded up their cargoes to take to this Western Hemisphere, it was the Arab slave traders who got the money. They were the ones who captured them, who marched them over there, and put them aboard those ships. The Muslims need to understand a little more of their own history. Now, never forget that education is, that attempt by the older generation to instill into the younger generation its, that is, the older generation's values, language, culture, religion, and societal activities, and so on. It's culture. They are force-fed. Yesterday, my wife and I saw in a restaurant here in Tyler one of the cutest little black girls you ever saw. And I can't help but comment to her, in a few more years, she'll know all about what her parents are going to teach her about white Americans, about slavery, about the honkies, about all that type of thing, because the older generation continues to absolutely twist and poison the minds of the younger generation. And when we see, you see this brown-eyed, precious little Iraqi girl standing there and looking up, receiving a piece of candy from an American soldier, give her parents about another 10 years. And then look out, because she'll be out in the street with her brother too, 15, 16, 17, going like this. They love to bounce. They love to bounce with their hands in the air, and they take their AK-47, they just bounce. Remind me of first graders. You just see them like that, masses of them. just bouncing in rejoicing against us and against the West. So, eventually, the older generation is going to be able to poison them. Now, did you know that right now in Iran there is an Iraqi Ayatollah? An Ayatollah is way above an Imam. He is sort of like a member of the College of Cardinals. He's at a much higher level than the Imams, who are the sort of a priests who harangue from the mosques every day at the time of prayer. He has a little army of his own, and they are expatriate Iraqis, 1,500 of them. He's a Shiite. You see, there was a Shiite revolution in Iran, remember. Now, I want to come back to a couple of points and give you a little bit of an interview that took place with him. But while I do that, I want to hold in abeyance for a moment that thought and go to something that is very, very important. Saddam Hussein attacked Iran, didn't he? He attacked Iran. Iran is an Islamic country. Did Iran present a threat to Saddam Hussein? He would have said yes, because 60% of the population of Iraq is Shiite. And it was a Shiite revolution, and he, being Sunni, nominally, he's not really a practicing Muslim at all. He is absolutely too cynical for that, and too much of a brutal murderer and a dictator. But he and his clique from Tikrit are Sunni. Now, the Shias claim that succession, the caliph, the word caliph in Arabic means successor. And so the Shia differences with the Sunnis is that the Shias believe that the living relatives, the successor of the prophet, should be the people in charge. And a caliphate of Baghdad was under a caliph who was supposed to be a successor. But the Sunnis believe it ought to be by election. And so there are some differences there in how the various Arabic states ought to be governed. Some people would say it's not a very big difference, but to them it certainly is. So Hussein perceived that there was a possible threat from Iran, because it was primarily in the grips of the Ayatollah Khomeini when they grabbed the American hostages, and it was also in the grips of an Islamic fundamentalist Shiite revolution. So in a preemptive attack, I emphasize again, Saddam Hussein, with his tank column supplied by the Soviets and his MiG-1, 2s, and 3s supplied by the French, his military hardware supplied by the Russians and the Europeans, waged war against Iran for 8 solid years. He, too, was surprised. He thought the war would be over in very short time. Instead, it bogged down along the Shatt el-Arab, and back and forth it wades along the border and up in the north with the Kurds, and there's a large Kurdish population in northern Iran, as well as there is in Iraq. And of course, during that war, because, again, of the Kurdish population, and they want autonomy, they want their own nation, some of them are in Turkey, some are in Iran, and some are in Iraq, and they want to carve out a nation and call it Kurdistan. And so he killed thousands of them by poisons and mustard gas, a cocktail actually of sarin and I think one other, and mustard gas that I've read about, that they mixed together and poured down upon those innocent men, women, and children and killed them all. So here's Saddam Hussein waging war for 8 solid years in which more than 1 million people died, and he did it against a fellow Islamic country. But his leaders and the entire Islamic world believe that we are the great Satan, absolutely don't have any causus belli, we don't have any reason whatsoever to attack this poor defenseless country that doesn't even have any weapons of mass destruction, and to wage war against these helpless Iraqi women and children. And what do you think they believe? How many do you think in Bangladesh, Pakistan, Indonesia, Iraq itself, Egypt, Yemen, are watching Fox and CNN? Well, there might be one intelligence agent somewhere in one of those countries that have been designated by his government to monitor it, to tape it, to translate it, and find out what we're saying. But if you think the general population really knows the truth and knows what is going on, they know nothing except what their own lying propaganda tells them. And they believe it right down to the ground. So, Saddam then attacked Kuwait. Why? Was Kuwait a threat against Saddam? Oh, of course not. Tiny little Kuwait. But he called it his 19th province. What did he want to do? Occupy it. And he did. Now, we're accused of wanting to occupy Iraq. Horrors. How could we even contemplate such a thing? Occupy a country that we're trying to subjugate by the force of military arms? Why would you want to do a thing like that? But look at history. Look at history. How long did we occupy the countries we subjugated during World War II? The denazification program was turned over to the Germans in 1947. General Douglas MacArthur helped the Japanese rewrite the Japanese Constitution, and the Japanese looked upon him as a deliverer eventually, because he kept the emperor in his palace. We sought no additional territories. We did not annex any part of Germany. We annexed no part of Italy, no part of Japan. Our troops wanted to come home as quickly as they could get home after the battle was over. That is absolutely a part of American history. We did not annex Panama. We, as a matter of fact, gave them their canal back. We did not annex Grenada. We drew our troops back the minute the war was over. We did not annex Kosovo or Yugoslavia. Our troops wanted to come home the minute it was over. And this happens to be truth, but they don't know that truth, they don't believe that truth, they don't understand it, and they're never told. Now, Saddam didn't have any perceived threat in Kuwait. He merely attacked out of the desire for hegemony and expansionism. He wanted to call it his 19th colony or his 19th state. He occupied it, he brutalized it, and he looted it. Now, they claim that the United States is waging a war of aggression instead of a war that is just and is moral. Now, let me draw an analogy as to whether or not you think there might be a just cause involved between the war Christ is going to wage and the war the United States is currently waging. Do you think there's any remote analogy that it even invites comparison? Think about it a minute. Wait a minute. Think about it. Why do we say we are involved in a preemptive strike? Because we know that if Hans Blix and his ilk could have their way and they go ahead and continue for another several months and then come back and give him a clean bill of health, that if they lift the sanctions, then the oil begins to flow and the billions of petrodollars begin to flow, and in less than 10 years, Saddam Hussein would have not only a vast nuclear arsenal, but ICBMs capable of delivering them half a world away in 40 minutes. And we know that that is true. It absolutely is the truth. And those anti-war demonstrators who know nothing, apparently, I don't know, well, some of them, it's actually been hijacked by some leftist organizations, Marxists, Leninists, and others have their little booths there. They've got their documents, their literature to hand out. And there are all kinds of various interest groups that are even, you know, getting some of these people excited and taking part in some of the anti-war demonstrations. That's another subject. All right. Matthew 24, 21 and 22 says that except those days were shortened. It talks about a great tribulation. There shall be great tribulation, such as was not from the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever indeed shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. Now, Moffat adds alive because it's not talking about salvation saved. It's talking about saved alive. There wouldn't be a man, woman, or child left alive. Now, think about that and think of the application of the analogy. We know that if Saddam Hussein were left alone, that in 10 years he could actually create a nuclear holocaust and there wouldn't be a man, woman, or child left alive in the modern nation of Israel. That would be his first target. Even if it cost him his life, he wanted to go down in history as another Saladin, a Nebuchadnezzar, or a Cyrus the Great. He attacked Iran because he wanted to reestablish under his own rulership the great world-ruling Persian Empire. He has visions of empire. He doesn't have visions of being a nice, peace-loving man inside of his own borders and producing a wonderful agricultural state there of happy people who are well-fed, well-clothed, and have plenty of water and all of that. Never was a part of his planning. So, does Jesus Christ of Nazareth, according to this scripture, perceive that there is a global threat? Yes, he does. Because he knows that given full rein, the nations of this world eventually will enter a nuclear bomb and chemical and biological weapon, World War III. and that eventually the exchanges could be so fierce that whole cities would disappear in a flash, millions dying in only moments, and there literally would not be a man, woman, or child left alive on the face of this whole good green earth. Christ himself says so. He says he is coming, to give another analogy, as mankind is hanging on the gibbet, just about to strangle to death, about to commit his own suicide. Genocide against himself. So he says, because he sees that threat, he's going to intervene in a preemptive strike. Christ is going to launch himself from heaven, and he's going to have weapons, because they're spiritual, that are far more effective than all the panoply of armor and weapons that we've got in our military. He will look into the hearts and the minds of the enemy. He doesn't care about the uniform they wear, whether ragtag, civilian, or all dressed up with some kind of scrambled eggs on their brim. He looks into their hearts and their minds. There will not be one single bit of collateral damage when Christ comes to wage war upon the earth. Not one innocent victim will lose his or her life or a limb or be even scathed or injured or hurt in any way. As a matter of fact, those who really believe in Jesus Christ and herald and applaud his coming, pray for it and wait for it and look for it and want to take part in it when he comes, are going to be completely preserved and protected, as will their families and loved ones. But the enemies, it says, in a moment the eyes will disintegrate in their sockets. The flesh will melt right off of their bones. They'll be standing one moment in a uniform with camouflage, pointing some kind of a weapon up into the skies, and the next moment a pile of bones sinks to the ground with nothing but a uniform there, where a flesh and blood human being used to be. Christ, then, is going to use such precision weapons that it looks into the minds and the hearts of people. No collateral damage. And if he didn't intervene, the world would not survive. So do you see the analogies? Do you see how it might apply? Our American and the UK government believe that they are in a preemptive strike because if they didn't, Israel wouldn't survive and World War III would begin because Saddam Hussein would trigger it. Would you rather be meeting Saddam Hussein today on these terms or Saddam Hussein 10 years down the line with a nuclear arsenal and ICBMs? The point has been made by our government, but I don't think very many people really believe it. I want to give you another very important quote from an African-American Islamic journalist. And I would urge all African-American young men to listen to this, because the first fragging incident, which is mind-boggling to me, and the man ought to be taken out by a military court and stood against a wall and shot. He murdered two of his own superior officers. He did so because he's a convert to Islam. So apparently we've got troops who have certain reservations. And even though they stood there and said, I swear to protect and defend the United States against all enemies, both foreign and domestic, etc., and took the oath of a military man and received all of the hundreds of thousands of dollars of training and weaponry and his food and clothing and all that for years to take him over there, he didn't want to wage war against any Islamic country. Why not? When all the Islamic countries have waged unremitting war against each other from time immemorial. And Saddam Hussein is the most outstanding example of that. But he's more righteous than all the rest of them. And so instead of just refusing to fight, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to be a conscientious objector in this particular way, so do with me what you will. He didn't have the honesty of his convictions. He was hiding out with a bullet in his leg in a bunker trying to escape. He couldn't stand up and say, I'm sorry, but I cannot take up arms against my fellow Muslims. So he just tried to kill all of his officers by rolling grenades in while they slept. What a rotten coward! What an unspeakable traitor! This from an African-American Islamic journalist. Quote, I didn't give it much thought while growing up in the United States. I never saw images of Arabs with dark skin and African facial features on television or in the newspapers. All the Arabs I saw on news accounts seemed to have about the same complexion as Saddam Hussein. So you can imagine my surprise when I, an African-American journalist and a Muslim, traveled in the Middle East and saw lots of people who looked like my friends and relatives in the United States. Eventually, I began to trace the link between Africa and the Arab world. My research took me back more than 1,500 years to African villages where slaves were captured, tied together, and marched to seaside fortresses. They were herded onto ships, and many wound up in what is now southern Iraq and Kuwait, where they became laborers, farmhands, servants, concubines, and eunuchs. Initially, many of the slaves came from Ethiopia and what is now Somalia. They were brought to what is now southern Iraq to build canals and turn marshlands into fields for crops, including cotton. The rulers needed more arable land and to feed the region's rapidly growing indigenous population. So the demand for slaves grew, but the supply dwindled along Africa's Indian Ocean coast. Two factors contributed to their scarcity. Some African ethnic groups began to resist the traders, and others converted to Islam. Muslim slave traders were prohibited from enslaving fellow Muslims. This forced Arab slavers to go deeper into Africa, eventually reaching present-day Malawi, Zambia, southern Sudan, and the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. End of quote. From an African-American Muslim journalist. Too bad the rest of the African-American population in our prison systems don't understand that little bit of history, because they are the most rapid growing group of Islamic fundamentalists who are listening to the lies of a man called Elijah Muhammad. And because he had no roots of his own, he had to borrow a civilization from ancient times and is actually hoodwinking and deceiving so many thousands of young American men that you have a situation like that which occurred the other day right on the battlefield. Pitiful. Unbelievable. Look at Isaiah 59:8-14. If there was ever a scripture that really just leaps off the page today, as you look at the machinations, at the chicanery, at the lies, at the propaganda, at the deceit of various national leaders here and there around the world, it says in verse 8, "The way of peace they know not." You know, one person said, "What good does war ever accomplish?" And someone retorted, "Well, let's see. It got rid of Napoleon. It got rid of Nazism, fascism, communism. What good did war ever accomplish? What good is the war that Christ is going to wage going to accomplish? World peace. How do you achieve peace? Through war. But only the war to end all wars, the war with those perfect weapons I'm talking about, the war with the most righteous cause in the history of all of mankind to save mankind from himself. The way of peace they know not." George Bush doesn't know the way to peace. Tony Blair doesn't know the way to peace. I thank God that they're in the position they are for the sake of God's work and the sake of us here in the United States who, at least if we're careful and keep our eyes open, are not as of this moment, not yet, the victims of terrorists. But the terrorists would love to make us their victims if there is any possible way they can bring that about. Don't you doubt that for one instant. The way of peace they know not, and there is no judgment in their goings. They have made them crooked paths. Whosoever goeth therein shall not know peace. Again, an analogy. Therefore is judgment far from us, neither does justice overtake us. We wait for light, but behold obscurity. I told you in a recent article in the website about the young man, it wasn't so young, I guess, in Britain, who had been robbed for, I think, about the 20th time. And this one time when he was robbed, he happened to be home, and he had a shotgun, and there were three of them who burgled his place of business, so he managed to kill one, injure another, and the third one escaped. Well, the government managed to come up with £5,000 that gave him the ability to sue, that is, the one who escaped, the ability to sue the man who had killed and then wounded one of his burglar companions, and so they convicted him of murder. And they put the original burglar victim in prison for a life sentence. But through an appeals process, he finally had it changed to manslaughter, so he only has to do 7 years in jail. In the meantime, the one who sued him is supposed to get a big financial settlement because he claims that he can't watch television where he hears the sound of gunfire without tearing up. And because he is in the business of karate and self-defense, he can't even do that anymore.
And besides that, he's unable to work. His job? He's a professional burglar. British justice. They'll always be in England. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? You know, it was Napoleon who said, four newspapers are far more powerful than 10,000 bayonets. And he was so right, because that's what Al Jazeera and the various media in the Islamic world are doing right now today. We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. We're in desolate places as dead men. We roar all like bears and mourn sore like doves. We look for judgment, but there is none. For salvation, but it's far off from us. Do you know, by the way, that both Tony Blair and George Bush got into it a little bit the other day? Oh, they didn't come to blows. They didn't even argue too heavily about it. But George Bush didn't really want to go back to the UN the way Tony Blair did. But Tony Blair has got to look at Europe over his shoulder. Tony Blair is offshore Europe in England, and there are an awful lot of sparks flying. And Jack Straw said he'd never take back what he said at the Brussels conference, nor did the other leaders in Britain who actually attacked the French and accused them of sabotaging the effort to get another UN resolution on top of the other 18 or 19 UN resolutions, which would have allowed the United States to have blanket, quote, permission, end quote, to go to war in Iraq. Well, you know that the French sabotaged it, as did the Germans. But do you know why? Well, I told you last week that one of the great big French oil companies, Elf Aquitaine, and also Total, the two biggest ones in France, were in on the ground floor with about 35 French businessmen who got there the minute the UN passed that resolution way back in 1995, I think, of oil for food. And they got in on the ground floor, and multi-billion-dollar contracts had been signed, and they were only waiting with bated breath for a signature on a piece of paper somewhere that would eventually give Iraq a clean bill of health. And Hans Blix and his people would say, we found no WMD, so go ahead and lift the sanctions and let the Iraqi oil flow freely. And the people in on the ground floor were French. And French and German businessmen have dozens of all kinds of things, of deals and contracts with the Iraqi nation. Now, I would say to George Bush, if I could, please, whatever you do, don't ever go back to the United Nations. America can go it alone with whatever allies of the willing we're able to gather around us. But don't ever go back on bended knee or on your belly to the United Nations. Let them die on the vine. Ignore them. Let moss and mold grow on that stupid building on the East River. And every time one of their designates with a diplomatic license plate runs a stop sign, arrest him and clap him in jail. Don't give them any kind of immunity. They've done everything from murder to rape to running over people in the street, and they don't have to pay for it. And I'm talking about things that have actually happened from UN delegates in the UN building, where I've been several times and interviewed some of them over the years gone by. But I'm afraid that at Camp David, a deal was struck. And so, because of Tony Blair's fears about his own political future and about Britain's future with regard to the deep rift between Europe as well as NATO and, of course, the European community, he wants to try to mend fences as best he can. So guess what? He's let the French back in. They're going to go to the United Nations, and they want the United Nations to once again crank up the Oil for Peace program now that the United States has secured the southern oil of Iraq. They want to get that oil flowing. The United States Special Forces went in and grabbed those pumping stations out in the Gulf and one of them up near Basra. And now they've got the oil wells fired, almost all of them put out, and the oil's going to flow, and guess who's going to benefit? The French. You read these scriptures about crooked ways that deals are struck, about the politics of the world, about why it is that we will never know peace, about the way world wars are waged, that we grope for the wall like the blind and can't seem to find the solution. Why is all of that? You know, at the beginning of this chapter, he says it isn't that God's arm cannot reach. It isn't that God's eyes are not upon you. It isn't that the Eternal cannot help. But your iniquities have separated between him and you that he will not hear you. Now, here we are. We are a commandment-breaking, not a commandment-keeping people. The very people who ought to be out in the forefront teaching people about God's laws are instead the people who are out in the forefront saying God's laws are done away. And I've given people a clue in the past to be cute about it. The one commandment they hate is not honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. The first commandment with promise, as Paul said. They are not, thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, thy neighbor's house, you know, and all of that. No, they don't hate that one. Thou shalt have no other God before thee. They don't hate that one. They don't hate any of the commandments but one, and it's found somewhere between the third and the fifth. And they hate that one. Now, back in December, because I had written a column at the request of Joe Kovacs, who was, I think, second or third in command at WND, the World Net Daily, not WMD, WND, World Net Daily. And they have millions of viewers and people that tap into their website. And I sent him a column, and it had to do with the origin of Christmas, and he displayed it. But one of their regular staff members, whose face is always on their front page and is a columnist for them once a week minimum, is Jerry Falwell. Makes me wonder what kind of heat descended upon those people so that in ensuing months, though I sent about five or six commentaries, one of which had to do with the UN and all the chicanery, and I sent the same one three times and never even got an answer from either Kovacs or the WND editorial department to whom I addressed my email. So that door has been slammed shut, and I'll guarantee you who slammed it. Because I know the way that kind of thing goes on. We are not a commandment-keeping people. I hate to tell you that eventually, though we may be given some years of respite, and I pray God that we will be, and I thank God for every month and every year of respite and breathing space and comparative peace that we might be able to have in the United States of America in order to do the work of God. I thank God for any kind of peace that my grandchildren and my children can expect, and all of you, brethren, and your loved ones, because I don't want the tribulation to descend upon the United States tomorrow or the next day or next year or during my lifetime or long after my lifetime. But it is going to come, and I can't stop it. The tribulation is coming upon Jacob, upon Ephraim and Manasseh, and we are Manasseh. We are a part of Israel. We are part of Jacob. And even if we're not, it's a dangerous world, and we now face enemies all over the world. North Korea. We face the enemy from within. We face terrorism and Islam. We're going to face the United States of Europe armed with nuclear weapons. We're going to face an awesome power that will shock its own architects when it becomes to be. Why, he says in verse 12, our transgressions are multiplied before thee, and our sins testify against us, and our transgressions are with us. 37 million Americans are absent today. 37 million Americans who could have been doctors, dentists, I won't say lawyers, let's just omit that part, teachers. They could have been artists, musicians. They could have been people who contributed to society. Maybe you will say, well, given who their mothers are, they wouldn't have had a chance. Well, you can argue that point. 37 million little living American babies have been murdered before they ever had a chance to draw breath. And some of them in a so-called partial birth abortion. A whole generation, enough to populate a major nation, are gone because they never had a chance to live. Abortion is a great sin, a horrible crime. It is murder. It is nothing short of that. And our nation and its Supreme Court are blood guilty. And until they remove that horrible stench in the nostrils of God, they are going to eventually suffer for it. Now, that's only one sin. I could point out dozens, and I'd keep you here for 4 hours if I did. So I will not go on. I'll forbear and not continue in that vein. But that is why America, though we have at the moment a righteous cause, we have at the moment a just cause. I believe it is a just cause. And I support it from that point of view as an American, not withdrawing from the God point of view and looking at the world through the eyes of Almighty God and of Jesus Christ. And I've confessed in the times past, and I confess it again today, that sometimes my patriotism and my spiritual beliefs find themselves in a little bit of turmoil. That's easy for any of us because that just happens to be the way it is. I'm an American, and I served my country in the Navy during the Korean War, and I'm proud of it. And if I were young and I had the chance to do it again, I would do it again. I told my shipmates just after 9/11 that if I were 18 or 19 again and I had a chance to stand at the forward brow of that aircraft carrier and put my sea bag on my shoulder and walk up there and go over and get those guys, I'd be one of the very first to volunteer. Because I know that my Savior Jesus Christ is not anti-war, he's merely anti-feudal wars and human wars and wars that don't go anywhere and don't really solve anything, but just create a lot of additional fodder and a lot of additional reasons for yet future wars which are going to come. He says, "For our transgressions are with us, and as for our iniquities, we know them," and we really do in this country, "in transgressing and lying against the eternal and departing from his laws and his ways." And I'm going to curtail that right there and not continue on. Away from God, it continues to say, "Speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood, and judgment is turned away backward, and justice stands afar off, for truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter." Final scripture. Here is what I believe, no matter what I may have said, what I may have written in all the commentaries, this is what I believe about war. And it's found in James 4, 1-3. "From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members?" That was certainly true of Saddam's attack against Iran and Kuwait. "You lust and have not. You kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you have not, because you ask not," because they don't approach God, and many of them don't even believe in God, let alone obey him. "You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your lust." They ask for God's favor so that they may get what they hope God will give them. But they do not approach God in heartbroken repentance. As Peter said, "Repent and save yourselves from this untoward generation." Well, as never before, we live in a time where Christ's words to pray always that we might be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man really take on very important meaning.